Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to introduce to you Shashi Tharoor. How do I pronounce? Shashi Tharoor. Let me first tell you that this guy is a nerd. He studies like hell. He had at 22 years old, he had a doctorate from Fletcher's University in Boston. He was born in London. He worked for almost two decades at the UN. Then he was a foreign minister of India. Then he went into politics in India, and he's now a member of Congress of Parliament in India. He's also a novelist, that has a tradition of looking at things in a different perspective, using lots of satire. To introduce its view of India and its view of the world. Two of his most famous novels are Show Business I forgot the name of the other one. Oh, The Great Indian Novel. So, and let me start by telling you that this conversation should have never happened. He was almost elected Secretary General of the UN. If the UN had been wise enough to understand that it needed the modernity, that it needed the diplomacy, that it needed what he brings to the table, they would have elected him. He was a candidate during the same election process of Ban Ki-moon. He always got the most amount of votes, but there was, you know how the UN works. There's five countries that have the veto power, and one of them vetoed him, the U.S. And so he declined his candidacy, even though he should have been elected, and Ban Ki-moon was elected Secretary General of the U.N. Why don't you tell our audience, Shashi, what was that about? How did that happen? Why are you not Secretary General of the U.N.?
Not because I didn't get as many votes as he did.
Because you got a veto.
No, the fact is that the Bush administration, I think, had a particular view of the kind of Secretary General they wanted. And their then ambassador, a man called John Bolton, has subsequently written in his memoir that the guidance he was given is, we do not want a strong Secretary General. It seems a very disloyal thing for an ambassador to write in his memoir, but there you are. It's not a very complimentary thing to say either about the man who did win, which is a bit unfair to him. But the fact is that one has to take these things in stride, and I have moved on.
Their loss, our gain. How did you take, after more than 20 years as a member of the United Nations?
And almost 29, in fact.
Almost 30 years, and I'm very critical of the UN. Does the world need the UN? If tomorrow the UN disappeared, would we miss it?
Yes, you would. And I'll tell you why. Because we're increasingly living in a world of what in Kofi Annan's time we used to call problems without passports. Problems that cross all frontiers uninvited. Problems that no one country or one group of countries, however rich or powerful they may be, can solve on their own. Problems like the environment, problems like climate change, refugee movements, human rights issues, terrorism, drug trafficking, human trafficking, and of course we've got the horrors of epidemic disease, things that cross borders and which no country can solve without the cooperation of other countries. You need a forum which brings all countries together to promote that kind of cooperation, and you need an organization to implement what these countries decide. That's what the UN accomplishes.
But the record of the UN is, pretty bad.
I don't agree.
It hasn't solved the problem of refugees. It hasn't solved the problem of climate change. As a matter of fact, the latest meeting of the climate change in Mexico was a failure. The veto power of the Big Five is an obstacle to any type of reform. And to a certain extent, and this is a criticism that I've heard many, many times, the success of the UN is when it solves problems and when it gets things done. But you look at the UN's track record, for example, in Africa, and they go into a country and they stay forever. They're not able to solve the problems and then leave.
I can't believe that a former vice president of Colombia thinks that all problems can be solved. I mean, the truth is...
Touché.
The truth is that there are many problems that have been solved and many problems that have not been solved. But if you look at refugees, for the most part, with the exception of the Palestinians, yesterday's refugees are not refugees today. And if we do it right, today's refugees need not be refugees tomorrow. There are always problems that can benefit from international cooperation. And there are problems where, frankly, human capacity will not solve them with whatever we do. But at least you have an organization that's capable of trying, that's capable of bringing in people from all parts of the world and actually putting aside their own national interests in the interests of a larger humanity. I think that's a worthwhile ideal. And for me, 29 years was well spent. I worked for refugees. I worked in peacekeeping. Particularly, I was Mr. Yugoslavia during the Civil War. I worked in Kofi Annan's cabinet. I had my own department. I had a tremendous range of experience at the UN, and not one minute did I feel that what I was doing was not worth the effort.
You see why he wasn't elected Secretary General. let me move on a little bit to another area or another element of your expertise, and it has to do with foreign policy. After 29 years of being a high-level ranking member of the Secretary General's office at the UN, you leave, and then you become Foreign Minister of India. Not long ago, I read at The Economist that the next conflict is going to come in Asia. You have two giants, China and India. China is going to become the number one economy in the world in the next 10 years. India is going to become the number two economy in the next 40 years. They need resources. They share water. They have contentious issues they haven't been able to resolve. How will the world avoid a conflict in which either China or Asia are not going to be involved?
Well, I can't speak for China, but speaking for India, I would say that we feel we have no particular interest in a conflict. We don't see ourselves in competition with China. We think that the world has enough needs and the world is large enough for there to be enough space for both China and India. And as far as our two economies are concerned, they're largely complementary. China is a hardware economy, we are a software economy. China is a manufacturing country, we are a services country. China is an authoritarian state, we are a democracy. We have very different contributions to make to the world and to each other. And so we feel there need not be any particular conflict because of our so-called rivalry. Having said that, I think that the era in which we saw that the world had to compete for resources has been supplanted by an era in which we are multiplying, partly through technology and partly through initiative, the various ways in which we are able to maximize resources for everybody. To give you two examples, China and India both need energy because we have to grow. In fact, in India, our plan is to grow our energy, our power supply, by 700% in the next 25 years. That's how much the demand is expected to grow.
Now, excuse me, 700%.
Seven times.
So how much is that?
How much is that?
Yeah, compared with Colombia's energy use is 50 gigawatts.
No, but I'll tell you, most people in Bogota can turn a switch on the wall and get power, get electricity. In India, even in the capital, New Delhi, today, we still have power cuts because we don't generate enough power for our present-day needs, let alone for the needs of the future.
How many people in India don't have access to
About
energy?
600 million Indians do not have access to electricity.
Okay.
About 600 million do. So you can see how much we need to increase so that every person can have a benefit. Now, obviously, there are some limitations as to how much you can do in this way, but one of the things we've done, for example, is that India and China, instead of always competing with each other, have tried together to actually share the products of an oil field in the Sudan, to give you one example. Now, I'm not saying we do this everywhere. In many places, China will pay more and get the oil field, or India will pay less or whatever. But the truth is, that not every issue of resources needs to be conflictual. Right now, we have rivers. The water problem is potential. We have rivers that flow from Tibet in China into India. And our worry remains, of course, if the Chinese decide to divert that water because they are a thirsty land. We in India have no particular desire to deny the Chinese of what they need. So we said, if you build dams to harness water for power and so on, and then you let the same water flow down to our country, we have no problem. But you don't divert the water. So far, the Chinese have assured us they're not diverting the water. So they get the benefit of the water, we get the benefit of the water.
But
these are all issues that have to be managed.
Let's go back
through
to
good
water.
Diplomacy.
Water is going to become a critical element in the relationship between China and India. Sure. You guys share the Himalayas. The Himalayas feed the main rivers in India and the main rivers in China.
Some of them,
when you have those ice caps melting as fast as they have in the rest of the world, in some point, I don't know, in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, India and China are going to have to fight for that or see how they can, you know, use that water that's going to become less and less so. How can that be solved with present technology and with interests of two nations that have 33% of the world's population?
I'm not pretending we already have the answers today, but even you're saying with present technology may not be reasonable, because if you're talking about a serious problem in 40 years, I believe that human ingenuity will produce new technologies in those 40 years, and there should be ways in which we can tackle these problems. Right now, you need skillful diplomacy to ensure that no one does anything that causes irretrievable damage to the other country. And right now, we have to recognize that there are legitimate needs on both sides. But if, as you fear, all the ice caps are melting and we end up with a genuine shortage of water every year, then we will have to find new creative solutions. But that's what human ingenuity is all about. Let us sit down and see what the scientists and engineers can come up with.
India is a fascinating country. You know, when you land in India, you're in a different planet. Different planet. The smells, the colors, the sun, everything is different. It's an amazing country that I invite you to go. I have an anecdote. The country, in 8 years as vice president, the country where they spoke the best about Colombia, and I couldn't believe my ears when I was hearing 50 of the biggest entrepreneurs in India talk about Colombia, was in India. They loved Colombia. They're doing lots of businesses. It's increasing dramatically. But it's a country full of paradoxes. You have a definition of India that it's mind-boggling. Everybody's now talking of India and the future of India. Ashoshi said, and I'm quote, "India is not, as people keep calling it, an underdeveloped country, but rather, in the context of its history and cultural heritage, a highly developed one in an advanced state of decay." What does that mean?
That's been quoted back at me a lot. It's an early sentence from my book, The Great Indian Novel, which is written in the late 1980s. And at that point, I think it was fair to say that decay was everywhere apparent. India was, if you like, the United States of the second century BC. It was the richest country in the world. People came to it from everywhere. Students were coming from China to study in India. We had traders. The Roman Empire was coming to get spices from India and so on. And from this era, where everything evolved to a great extent, India declined. It had many periods of defeat, of colonialism, of lack of independence. And finally, by the time I wrote the sentence, one could see decay everywhere. I'm very pleased to say that in the 22 years since I wrote that book, India has recovered from its decay. And there is a tremendous spirit of revival, of enthusiasm, of growth once again. So fortunately, that is a sentence that comes with a date attached. You don't have to say it's true today.
But this one that you say, you said it's true now. And it's a very interesting definition of what India is. And I quote, "If America is a melting pot, then to me, India is a thali, a collection of sumptuous dishes in different bowls. Each may not mix with the next, but they combine on your palate to produce a satisfying repast. The diversity of India is amazing. What do you refer when you speak about this dali of different languages,
yes,
colors?
A thali actually is an Indian dish. You can get it in an Indian restaurant. And one of the things is that whereas the whole notion of creating an American is the melting pot notion, you pour people from all sorts of ethnic backgrounds and colors and languages into one cauldron, you stir it, and out comes the homogeneous American man or woman. Notion we don't have in India. In India, we are a collection of very many different ethnicities, religions, languages, colors of skin, appearance, and there is much less intermixing than you would think normal in one country. It's very easy to tell a Bengali apart from a Punjabi, and they're both Indian, but they are different people. Or a Muslim from one part of the country against a Sikh from another part of the country, you would see the difference. But at the same time, the Indian experience is these are all people who sleep under the same stars and dream the same dreams. They are all in the same adventure, and that's what I mean by a thali. They're all different bowls. You'll find it very rare for a Sikh to marry a Muslim or something like that. So they're all in different bowls, and the different bowls are not flowing into each other. But together they make up the mosaic of India. On one plate, they combine to give you a meal. And in fact, some of the great adventures of India, I can tell you, I was elected in the election of 2009, but in the previous election of 2004, my party, the Congress Party, won the election. It was led by a woman leader of Italian descent and Roman Catholic faith, Sonia Gandhi, who then made way for a Sikh gentleman with a turban, Manmohan Singh, to be sworn in as Prime Minister by a Muslim president, President Abdul Kalam, in a country that is 81% Hindu. That is India. It's a complete celebration of diversity where it doesn't matter what your background is, what your name is, what the color of skin is, what sounds you make when you speak, what kind of God you worship or not, so long as you agree to play by the same rules as everybody else. And that's the great magic of democracy.
And this diversity and this communalism, which was something that Nehru and Gandhi said, you know, we got to stop this, we got to stop this confrontation between different religions, and that produced the division between Pakistan and India, to a certain extent is still there, and some extremist parties promote that division and this Hinduism as a maximum of... is there an Indian nationality? Is there a communal view of what India is and should be and how it can reach its goals of development?
You see, the singular thing about India is that you can only speak of it in the plural. To speak of one Indian nationality, some sort of homogeneous, typical thing that excludes others, is not possible in India. There are people of the Hindu faith who have tried to say that Hinduism should be the national identity of India, what they call Hindutva, Hinduness. But the truth is that even though 81% of Indians adhere to the Hindu faith, this particular political tendency has never won at its peak more than 25% of the vote. Because Hindus themselves recognize that what the British wrongly call tolerance, which we would better call coexistence, is much more real in the Indian experience. We are simply used to accepting the notion of difference. It's so amusing, for example, that if you look at my state, Kerala, we have the oldest Jewish community in the world outside Palestine, because the Jews, after the destruction of the first temple and after the destruction of the second temple, got into boats and crossed the Arabian Sea and landed in Kerala, in my home state. And then we have the oldest Christian community in the world outside Palestine, because St. Thomas, the apostle, Doubting Thomas, he came across the waters in 52 AD, landed in Kerala, and was welcomed on shore by a flute-playing Jewish girl. And he converted people to Christianity. So there are people from Kerala in India whose ancestors have been Christian longer than any Colombian or any European, for that matter, has ever been Christian. So these are some of the... And Islam, again, in the lifetime of the Prophet. Again, across the waters of the Arabian Sea came the travelers, the missionaries, the traders, and they brought the message of Islam and brotherhood to Kerala. So you've got all of these faiths, and they were all welcomed. They were always welcomed. There's a wonderful story of a group called the Parsis. They were refugees, the Zoroastrian faith, from Persia in the 7th century AD, fleeing Muslim persecution. And the story goes that they came in their ship to the western coast of India, to Gujarat. And when the ship came full of these refugees, the king of that area said, "We don't want you, we have no room for you." But because they didn't have a language in common to explain that they had no room for them, he sent an emissary, and the emissary took a glass of water full to the brim, and he put a stone in it, okay? And when the water spilled out, he said, "You see, there is no room for you in this. The water will spill out." So the Parsi leader, the refugee leader, very clever man, he told the emissary, "Wait," and he asked for a glass of milk. And into the glass of milk, he stirred a spoonful of sugar to show that the addition of this group would only sweeten the milk. Nothing would have to spill out. And the result was that, indeed, the king was so touched by this message that he invited the Parsis to remain. And so on. You have stories like this in all parts of India. We have every kind of group imaginable who have come from the Greeks under Alexander, who first came to conquer, could not conquer, but left their people behind and left, all the way up to these stories of the Parsis, the Muslims, and so on. And the result is a country where you have all these differences. You find Indians who literally cannot understand each other's language because the languages are so different. Between my wife and me, our mother tongues are more different than Spanish and Russian.
We have different scripts. She's from where?
She's from Kashmir.
Okay.
And I'm from Kerala. Siri, why don't you stand up and say hi? My wife. So we have these differences, and yet we accept difference. That is the great strength of India, is the acceptance of difference. And I genuinely believe it is a lesson for other countries in the world, that coexistence is about acknowledging that you can be yourself and I can be myself, but we can both be Indian. And the same way that I can be Indian and you can be Colombian and we can both be citizens of the world. That principle, I think, is extremely valuable, and it's one of the lessons that we are able to offer from our experience.
How much of this ability to share those differences and solve them through democratic means, and India, the biggest democracy in the world, it has to do with the British being, you know, the colonial element of part of the modern history of India?
Well, the British spent 200 years denying us democracy, so it's very difficult to give them any credit for it. But I will say that the one thing that that I blame the British for is our parliamentary system. Because when the Americans in 1776 fought for independence, they said they were fighting for the rights of Englishmen. Similarly, our Indian nationalist leaders, though they never used the phrase, were also trying to fight for the rights of Englishmen. They were educated very much in the English way, and they wanted the same rights that English people had. And so they thought that the Westminster-style parliamentary system, which the British had devised for themselves, was also the best one for India. In fact, the British Prime Minister Clement Attlee, who came with a constitutional commission to India, said that when he suggested that a presidential system might be better for India, that the Indian leaders he spoke to reacted with horror, as if he had been offering them margarine instead of butter. It's a great line by Attlee. And I think that they made a mistake. Honestly, the parliamentary system of the British style works very well in a small island country where people are more or less similar, where the constituencies are very small, and where ideological differences can be simply divided in a parliamentary system. In India, where we have 85 political parties, where we have all this rich diversity, and where at the same time keeping a government running takes an enormous amount of time and energy, I think we would have been better off with the presidential system you have in Colombia. I think it would have probably been able to give us more decisive executive action than we have today.
One of the most interesting elements about Indian democracy and Indian political system is the federal system, which is really, really strong, and I think it's related to the diversity that India has. But how much has that diversity, federalism, parliamentary system made India more of a bureaucratic state that can hardly solve the problems of its citizens? You look at India growing 6, 8, 10% almost for the last 10, 15 years. And the bridge you have to cross between the very poor and the very rich, still huge.
No, you're totally right. In fact, in some ways, I look at our system where we have elected village councils, we have state assemblies like local parliaments, you have the national parliament, you have governors and chief ministers, then you have the central government. I mean, I think the one good of this system is that we have reduced the unemployment rate amongst politicians. There are lots of jobs for politicians in our country. But having said that, whether it is the most efficient way of dealing with our challenges, I agree that is a real question. I think that that our need today is to overcome the huge problems of poverty confronting a large section of our population. We estimate about 260 million Indians are below the poverty line. And this is a poverty line drawn barely this side of the funeral pyre. It's very, very poor level of subsistence. There are people above the poverty line who live in conditions that would shock you. So we have a huge challenge there. And at the same time, we have great potential. For example, today, 65% of our population is under 35 years of age, which means that for the next 30 years, at least, we will have a youthful, dynamic, and working age population at a time when the rest of the world, including China, is aging. But this will only be an asset if we can open our economy sufficiently to generate enough jobs for these people, because as we know in Colombia and in India, everywhere else, there is nothing more dangerous than unemployed young men who can easily turn to violence and rebellion and so on if they don't have more constructive outlets for their energies. So it's very important for us in India to have economic growth that generates enough employment to absorb this extraordinary young population. Then it can be a huge, huge demographic dividend for us.
You're speaking about violence and the difficulty of young men. India has a challenge, I wouldn't say a big challenge, and has to do with the Maoist guerrillas that expand in the western, northwestern part of India. How big is that problem, and how is India dealing with that that problem?
Well, the problem is big in the sense that 165 of India's 625 districts are affected, but they're not all equally affected. We have Maoists in some areas who really have taken over certain parts of these districts and are almost ruling them. And then other districts counted in the 165 are places where they may have set off a bomb or attacked a police station or whatever, and no more than that. But it is a serious problem. I don't think that most of the people who call themselves Maoists would know who Mao is or would have read a single idea of Mao's. But they are told by the few intellectual elite leaders that this is the way forward, that you must, you know, it's rather like the Senderoso Luminoso in Peru, that these are people who have come out of universities and have ideas which they are now experimenting with on the backs and on with the blood of young innocent people in the villages who are unhappy and feel that the bullet at least gives them something than that the ballot has not. If you look at the areas where the Maoists are active, most are in areas that we call our tribal areas. We have our own aboriginals. We call them Adivasis. They're people who are forest dwellers and who, by and large, have not been able to take advantage of the modern economy. And therefore, these people are more prey to the blandishments of terrorists, of Maoists, and so on. I would say that this is a serious internal problem, almost as serious as the external problem of terrorism exported to us from Pakistan, which is the other big national security issue for us.
Yes, I was going to go into that. What Pakistan, you live in a pretty rough neighborhood. You're very near border with Pakistan. You have China, you have Sri Lanka, finished conflict. You're right next door to Iran, Bangladesh, Afghanistan. How do you deal with that neighborhood and being such a huge economic and military power to a certain extent? How do you deal with that neighborhood? How can you not let that instability that surrounds you affect Indian growth, development, and security?
Well, we do try to be a constructive force in the neighborhood. We have been behind an organization called the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, or SARC, sort of like the OAS or the Andean community, or whatever, a way of getting countries together to cooperate. But I have to admit that we cannot claim that we have succeeded very effectively in doing that, because the Pakistani problem remains a thorn in the flesh of the success of this organization. But it's an organization that includes Pakistan, Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, all of these countries. However, a problem with any organization when one member is so much larger than the others is that we take up too much space around the table. So that alone will not be the answer. I would say that the other things we have to do, frankly, if we can set a good example to the rest, they will perhaps have a good reason to emulate us. So, for example, our economic growth can offer a market to our neighbors, can offer economic possibilities of trade as well as investment to them. They have to move away from their fear that India will swamp them by putting in necessary protections if they wish, but at the same time taking advantage of what we have to offer. Today, a number of situations have improved. Sri Lanka, the war is over, and we have good relations with them. Bangladesh has elected democratically a government that is very sympathetic to India. They have actually got hold of a couple of the terrorist groups there and turned them over to us. And Nepal, we have a Maoist movement in Nepal, but we have played constructive diplomatic, we made constructive diplomatic efforts to get the Maoists to participate in the democratic government in Nepal. That story is not completely over, but it's still going on, and it's an important issue. We're watching it carefully. Then you have Afghanistan, where India has been doing an enormous amount of development work in Afghanistan. If there is 24/7 electricity in Kabul today, it's because Indian engineers have built electricity lines 3,000 meters high to make it work. We are building hospitals, schools for girls, maternal clinics, and so on, even roads across Afghanistan. So we are trying to contribute in that way, in that area. I can say that, you know, one can go through a long list, but the main thing is we try to be a force in a positive sense in our neighborhood. But we understand that some of our neighbors, in particular our Pakistani friends, do have an issue. The Pakistanis, unfortunately, have never quite recovered from the trauma of our birth as independent countries. It was a birth that was simultaneously an abortion. And you end up with a country like Pakistan, which in so many ways is not a real country. It's, you know, in India,
That's a little bit of politically correct.
No, politically incorrect. Because we don't. If I was a minister, I would not say it. As a as a private citizen, I can say it.
You know, that's another characteristic that our guest has. He says a lot of things that get him into trouble because he speaks his mind.
That's true.
And I can relate. I can relate to that. As a politician, I had my own set of problems because I said the same type of things. But continue, please.
No, I was just saying. You know, whereas in India, the state has an army. In Pakistan, the army has a state. And that becomes a bit of a problem for our neighbors because the army already controls a larger percentage of the GDP of Pakistan, of one country, than any one country in the world. In no country does a military command such a large share of national resources. And so the result is, quite frankly, that we are in a position where the military is interested in protecting its own interests. Therefore, they wish to keep hostility with India alive. And because of the Afghan problem, the West has a lot more, shall we say, understanding of the wishes of the Pakistani military than we consider entirely healthy. And so lots of Western assistance goes to Pakistan, and a good chunk of that, billions of dollars, comes in, and some of that is spent to attack India. That's our joy in life these days. But we are doing our best.
A so-so neighbor like we have here in Colombia.
Exactly. He's stretching my diplomatic limits also.
India and Latin America, what's the future of that relationship? How do you see a country and a region that have not always looked in the same direction, that are, you know, oceans apart, literally and mentally?
I think, you know, you already said at the beginning of your remarks how much Indians are well-disposed towards Colombia. And I would stress that this is very much the case towards Latin America in general, though Colombia is a particularly good relationship. I would say that what is happening with India and Latin America is that we are very, very, how can I say, we're finally ready to overcome the long period of neglect on both sides. We have really grown up in India without knowing enough about Latin America. Language has been a problem. We have not very many Spanish-speaking Indians, and that has been one of the issues. A second issue has been distance, though in the 21st century, they say geography is now history, so we should actually overcome the great kilometers between us much more easily. And at the same time, the potential is so unexplored, whether it is Indians coming in to invest in Colombia, which is in Latin America generally, which is happening, or whether it is your facilities and resources being made available to us. The opportunities for developing our cooperation are truly limitless. And in all sorts of unexpected ways, there are the obvious things like Indian investors coming into agriculture in Latin America, in mining, manufacturing, and so on. But if I can give you an amusing sidelight, we have an ancient Indian medicine called Ayurveda, which is a traditional holistic treatment, including massages and oils and so on. And there is one Indian Ayurvedic doctor in Bogota who has set up a practice and married a Colombian who dresses like an Indian now, and they practice Ayurveda. And when I saw President Uribe last year, after I had come to see you, he said to me that he was very interested in more Indian Ayurvedic practitioners coming to Colombia, that Colombia was very interested in alternative medicine. So there is an unusual example of something, you know, you hear of Indian yoga, which is, of course, much more widespread. And I hope you will soon have Indian restaurants in Cartagena.
That's my only regret. I worked to bring foreign business here. I was very successful in oil, in gas, in cars, in technology. I was unsuccessful in bringing a good Indian restaurant to Colombia. We don't have a good Indian restaurant, and I think that's a big hole in our gastronomic experience. So that's a regret that I'll take to my grave.
No. But well before your grave, we will solve that problem. I think we will take back the message to our friends. No, the truth is that in Britain today, for example, Indian restaurants have proliferated to such an extent that Indian restaurants in England employ more people than the iron and steel, shipbuilding, and coal mining industries combined. So the empire can strike back. We were trying to do the same.
Let me finish with a small discussion regarding literature. Let me start by telling you and telling our public that I'm a huge fan of Bollywood movies. I love Bollywood movies. Once I was in a plane with my brother-in-law, and you know, we were going to France, to Paris, and he was watching, you know, this beautiful French movie, you know, ooh la la, sophisticated. And all of a sudden, he peeks and said, you know, what are you watching? And I said, I'm watching a Bollywood movie. I love Bollywood movies, the biggest movie industry in the world. How important is Bollywood to India and your novel, Showtime, which is about that industry?
Right. Well, actually, the Spanish edition of my novel, Show Business, is called Bollywood. It's done by Tusquets in Barcelona. But the thing is that the Bollywood film industry is, as he said, the largest industry in the world. Four times as many movies are made in India as in Hollywood. Over 800 films a year. And the thing about Bollywood films is they are very easy to understand and enjoy. I have a friend in New York who's Senegalese. And his illiterate mother in a village in Senegal takes a bus every month to the capital city of Dakar just to watch a Bollywood movie. Now, she can't understand the dialogue. She's illiterate, so she can't read the French subtitles. But these movies are made to be understood despite such handicaps. And so you can enjoy the song and the dance and the action and the love and the drama and the villainy. All the characters are painted in much larger than life colors. And the result is that she goes away enjoying a good cinematic experience. It is escapism. It is froth and glitz and glamour, but it is something which is a different kind of cinematic idiom from the realistic cinema of today in the rest of the world. And so you have to park your brains on the side when you sit to watch the movies. Don't expect to be intellectually challenged, but you will find that it appeals to the lowest common denominator of any viewing audience, and that is now becoming very, very widespread globally. In fact, in the Arab world, very common. I was in Oman the other day. I had dinner with a man who owned all the five cinema theaters in Oman. And I said, what do you show? And he said, I show Bollywood movies. I said, oh, you must have a lot of Indians in your country. He said, 85% of my audience are Arabs. So this is how the films are spreading. And in Germany now, there is a Bollywood revival. So Bollywood is extremely important. When I wrote my novel, which is now 20 years old, Show Business or Bollywood in Spanish, it was a novel in which I tried to use the Bollywood cinema as a metaphor for Indian society, about the kinds of stories a society tells about itself, which has been my preoccupation in my three novels. But in this one, I was also struck by the fact that in that time, 20 years ago, we only had 50% literacy rate in India at that time. It was an improvement from the British days. The British left us with 18%, but still it was not enough. But that meant that cinema had a particular role in our society because it became the principal vehicle for the transmission of the fictional experience. If half the people could not read, you had to either tell them stories or they had to watch stories on the screen. So the poorest villager in a dark village in India will go to a movie in order to hear a nice story, to see a nice story. And that means that the experience of fiction, which is something that we in literature are so concerned about, is not conveyed only through the written word. It can also be conveyed for illiterate people through cinema, folk theater, and other means. And cinema is the biggest audience reacher of the lot.
And the other novel, the other great novel, the great Indian novel that you wrote, this one is based in Bollywood, and the other one is based in the Mahabharata, which is the biggest epic, historic epic, fight between the gods of India, written 800 before Christ. And yet, both of them have a lot of satire in it. What's the Mahabharata, so that you can explain our public, and why satire?
Well, the Mahabharata is actually, as he said, an ancient epic. It's composed for about 800 years, between roughly 400 BC and 400 AD. And it is a tale of a great epic battle between two rival dynasties. But it was a tale that was told and retold for those 800 years. And each time it was retold, more elements were added into it. So at one point, it became almost the National Library of India. Everything of Indian philosophy, Indian wisdom, Indian stories, Indian spirituality, Indian caste system, everything was crowded into the story. And then roughly around 400 AD, people stopped telling the story. So in 1987, 88, when I was writing it, I said, why did we stop retelling the story? Suppose I were to retell the story in the 20th century about the great events of my time. How would I do it? Now, I could not do that in a serious vein alone, because that would have been very pretentious. So I did it as a satirical novel of 20th century India from the British days to the then present, a political satire of the political history of India using characters, episodes, philosophies, digressions from the Mahabharata, which is an epic that is five times as long as the Bible. So I had plenty that I could draw from and reinvent. And I did it, it's actually a verse epic. It's told in poetry. And I couldn't, obviously, no one could do it. In fact, no one has yet successfully translated the entire epic in verse. Some translators have tried. One died after doing 20 volumes. Successful translator did something very clever. He translated it into prose, but occasionally broke into verse to convey something of the poetic quality of the original. And I thought I would borrow that for somewhat less reputable reasons. And I broke into light verse and doggerel and limericks and humorous verse in order to poke fun and to give you a transition. Because, you know, after all, when you're talking about political history, the nationalist movement of India and so on, you're talking about something that's very venerated. When you talk about the epics, you're also talking about something that is very respected. And I did not want to repeat the hagiology of that era. I wanted to cast the light of the ancient epics upon the events of the 20th century, and similarly the sensibility of the 20th century upon the lessons of the ancient epics. And through the refraction of those two different kinds of light, I wanted to illuminate the reader's mind in a different way. That was what that novel tried to do. So that was satire, Show Business was satire. And my third novel, which is the only novel that has been published in Colombia by Norma, is a novel called Riot in English, Disturbio, I believe, in Spanish. And this is a novel which is not a satirical novel, but a rather serious exploration of Hindu-Muslim violence in India in the late 1980s. So it's a bit different. Each of my novels is very different from the next. But I've tried in my novels always to explore, as I said, the kinds of stories that a society tells about itself. In the first novel, the Mahabharata was this great epic. Even today, every grandmother will tell stories from the Mahabharata to her children, to her grandchildren. So it's very much present in our contemporary consciousness. What do these stories reveal about our lives? And of course, the political stories of the nationalist movement. In show business or Bollywood, I took the popular stories of our popular cinema. In Riot, I took the great historical myths. This is a story set around a genuine problem where a mosque was built on a site that Hindus claim was the birthplace of an ancient god in the Ramayana, god Ram, and that mosque was destroyed in a violent attack by Hindu extremists in 1991. So the mosque, the stories about the mosque, the question of the ownership of history, these were also my concerns in this novel. So each of my novels does anchor itself in the contemporary nature of India, in the forces that have made India and have nearly unmade it. And that's my continuing literary obsession with my country.
I'm going to open it up to the public, but before, you can see, a nerd, a diplomat, a politician, a writer. I think you're going to follow him. You're going to see that he's going to have a run to many other things. He's still very young. And just to know what he's going to run or what he wants in the future, I'm going to quote something that I found of what he has said. I make no bones about the fact that India matters to me, and I would like to matter to India. He certainly matters to India now, and I have no doubt that we will hear a lot more from Shashi in the near future. So I'll open up to questions. Allá a la izquierda. Ah, bueno.
Thank you for your wonderful talk. A question about how Mahatma Gandhi would evaluate contemporary India, and therefore also how would he evaluate global affairs?
Sorry, I would evaluate?
International. The first question is, and then international too.
Well, India, I think, would probably not have pleased Gandhi very much for a number of reasons. I think he would have been pleased about the fact that democracy has survived, and he would have been, by and large, pleased with the principles of coexistence that India has stood for. But he was very much a believer in economic self-sufficiency. So today's globalized India, which has become so connected to the rest of the world, might have puzzled him. And I think he would also have been a bit disappointed, perhaps, by the moving away from self-contained village economies and almost, village communities weaving their own cloth and growing their own food, to the kind of modern economy we have today in India and elsewhere in the world. He was very much a believer in what Schumacher called small is beautiful, and in very simple elementary technologies and so on. And I think that arguably he was already behind his own time, but today he would be, if he continued in those beliefs, he would be very, very, very much behind the curve and therefore perhaps disappointed. More importantly, Gandhi would have been disappointed about the betrayal of the fundamental element of his message, which was that the means are as important as the ends. Gandhi, I think, was the only politician in the 20th century to make a fetish, almost, of his fundamental belief that you cannot achieve justice through unjust means, that you cannot achieve a good end through wrong conduct. So this business of means and ends meant, for example, that he only used nonviolence to try and overcome the colonial oppressor. He had the perhaps frighteningly unrealistic view that if somebody raises arms against you, you should turn the other cheek. That ultimately, the way in which you did something was as important as the goal you were trying to attain. That Gandhian belief is essentially largely absent from much of India's and the world's political life today. The fact that so many wars exist, the prevalence of terrorism, all of these things, I think, would have caused him a great deal of concern.
Buenas noches. Le agradezco mucho su visita. Yo, como colombiana, me siento totalmente honrada. Y creo que mi patria también, porque me alegro profundamente de ver un ser humano totalmente holístico. Y lo digo con permiso de Dios, porque me parece que usted tiene un campo que los seres humanos no hemos, de pronto hemos descuidado mucho, que se llama espiritualidad, porque ese es un componente de la humanidad que de pronto, no sé por qué razón, nos hemos alejado muchas veces por el devenir de la vida y del mundo, nos hemos alejado de la realidad que es que el ser humano trasciende de una energía superior, que yo llamo Dios. Quisiera saber, porque me ha impactado mucho su disertación, cómo usted como ser humano y como digo holístico, veo que su espiritualidad hace parte de su devenir político. Si uno se pone a mirar la política y en relación con la verdad y la justicia, está muy alejada de lo que es en relativo a la espiritualidad. Entonces yo quisiera saber cómo hace usted en el campo político hacer un uso bello de eso que usted tiene, que se llama espiritualidad. O sea, ¿cómo aplica espiritualidad en política? Gracias.
Thank you for that question. Well, first of all, when I answered Francisco on the differences between India and China, that was something I should have said, because one of the major differences between our two societies is that China has cut itself off from its old spiritual heritage, whereas in India, the spiritual and religious tradition is completely alive. In many ways, we are practicing the sorts of beliefs and values and philosophies that have existed on the soil of India for 4,000 or 5,000 years. And that is an enormous, enormous difference. About Indian politics, I have to admit that very few politicians are truly spiritual. I don't know if that's not true in Colombia, but it certainly is in India as well. I mean, we find that the business of politics very rarely allows space for the spiritual. And yet in India, there have always been spiritual leaders who've been looked up to by politicians. There are political figures who gave up politics and turned to the world of the spirit. The spirit of renunciation is very highly respected in India, and we have a couple of major leaders who acquired a certain moral standing by renouncing politics and in turn were able to have an influence on politics from the outside. And at the same time, the kind of politician who clearly has a spiritual core, a decent core to him or her, always enjoys the respect of the public. But I would not be correct to suggest that the vast majority of Indian politicians have any particular spiritual bent. They are more likely to go to temples looking for votes or go to astrologers than to go to spiritual gurus.
Están ustedes en medio de un continente donde hay jugadores muy fuertes y de mucho poder. Quisiera saber cuáles son los países sobre los cuales la India tiene una influencia marcada, o son pro-indios o los aliados tradicionales en el campo de la diplomacia, porque ya sabemos lo de China, que es un superpoder. Entonces, en ese contexto de Asia, ¿cuáles son los países pro-indios o con los cuales ustedes han contado como aliados?
Well, India, as you know, was famously non-aligned. It did not conclude alliances. There is a story of Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, a man who once declared that non-alignment between good and evil was itself evil. And Dulles allegedly said to our Prime Minister, Nehru, in a phrase that has become much more famous in recent years in the mouth of a recent American president. It is said that he asked, "Are you with us or against us?" And Nehru replied, "Yes." In other words, we are with you when we agree with you. We are against you when we disagree with you. And that has very much been India's principle. So India has been very right, did not join any of the alliances, did not join CENTO or CETO or any of those groups. It stayed away from alliances. But at the same time, of course, it represented a certain tendency amongst many of the former colonial countries when they had won their independence. A big country like India felt that an important objective was to create its own strategic autonomy, to create its own space in the world. And therefore, it was more important to India to be able to make up its own mind on issues rather than to be influenced by allies, as you asked. So we have good relations, we hope, with many countries. We have not so good relations with some countries, but formal alliances we don't have.
Two more questions, and I want to hear. Shashi is going to be signing books after this session to whomever wants to get his book or her book signed. So he's going to be outside signing books.
Sir, may I add that Gandhi would not be amused, as they used to say about the former queen, with India becoming a nuclear power and playing the devil's advocate. Pakistan became a nuclear power as a reaction. I mean, you launched the first experiment in 1974, if I remember well. What do you? Is there any way? Can you update us on the status of India as a nuclear power and to what extent that exacerbated the rivalry and the potential for a Holocaust in Asia?
See, India's position on nuclear weapons is actually fundamentally remains Gandhian despite what has happened, in that India has been the one country in the world that has consistently and from the beginning advocated universal nuclear disarmament. India put forward a number of proposals in the 1950s. It put forward Rajiv Gandhi's proposal in 1988. It has gone to a number of international gatherings proposing a scheme for universal nuclear disarmament. It bitterly opposed the Non-Proliferation Treaty because it rightly saw this treaty as the five then nuclear powers finding a creative way of preserving a nuclear monopoly for themselves. It was like an apartheid system in international law, that we are good enough to have something, the rest of you cannot have it. And that was unacceptable morally, and I think even Gandhi would have agreed it was unacceptable. So India's nuclear logic is a bit different. India's nuclear logic is nuclear weapons are evil and bad, and no one should have them. But if some can have them, then we will have them too. There is no reason why China, which has fought a war with us and humiliated us in that short war in 1962, should have a nuclear weapon that we should not have. That is very much the Indian thinking. Now, I happen to personally agree with you. I'm not a fan of nuclear weapons. I would even go so far as to say that the adoption of a nuclear weapon and Pakistan following suit has actually created a strategic parity in the subcontinent, which would not have existed if it was only conventional weapons involved. But be that as it may, the genie is out of the bottle. India remains a country that wants to put the genie back in the bottle. We are still in favor of some plan, such as, for example, the Baruch plan in the late 1940s, which said that all nuclear weapons should be surrendered by all countries. The technology cannot be uninvented, but it should be kept under control of an international organization under safe lock and key. Until something like that happens, we will not agree that there is any greater virtue to Britain or France or America or China or Russia, that they are entitled to have nuclear weapons and we are not. We think it's bad for everybody. It's bad for us. It's also bad for them.
Last question.
I wanted to thank you, first of all, for being here. My second question, my question is regarding the young population in India. I have encountered a lot of Indians abroad, and I've seen that most of the young population wants to study abroad, learn, and then go back to India. And I wanted to know how the Indian politics and culture actually encourage that as a lesson to Colombians or to Latin Americans to come back to the countries and work for them?
Well, you know, initially, those Indians who went abroad who had scientific training and background, particularly engineers and doctors, did not come back to India, primarily because the standard of living and the income they were able to have in the Western world was vastly greater than what was available in India, and also because the research facilities and the technical capacities of India were not up to the standards of what they could have in their domain. So we had, for example, a couple of Indians have won Nobel Prizes in the sciences as American citizens. And they were Indians who could not find jobs in India in the same fields in which they researched in America to become Nobel winners. A lot of the companies in Silicon Valley were founded by Indians who were in the software and engineering areas and who knew more than others in America, but who could not in those days have practiced their professions with similar opportunities in India. Today, that story has changed dramatically. First of all, India itself has moved very, very far forward in the research and development area. We have now decided to double our percentage of GDP being spent on research and development. And already IBM, GE, Philips have more researchers in India than they have in America or Europe. We are finding, for example, that Indian brains, as it were, given the right research environment and adequate compensation, not necessarily American-style salaries, are much happier living in India with their culture, with their food, with their families, and at the same time contributing to the best of their brain power in their particular professional fields. For this reason, fewer people are leaving. For example, when I was a student in the 1970s, our top elite institutions of engineering, the child who came out at the bottom of the class would be guaranteed a scholarship to an American university because the standards were so high and the opportunities in India were so few that often an entire graduating class of an Indian Institute of Technology, IIT, would move to America. Today, maybe half at most would apply and half of those would actually go. So that a lot of people are finding opportunities in India that were not available one generation ago. Secondly, you're finding that those who do go, some of them come back. Not all. You have two kinds of contribution. One is those who remain in the West, but who contribute to India by investing in India or by opening businesses in India or by bringing their companies into partnership with Indian companies and so on. And the second kind are those who actually come back to India and live there because they find that the attraction of Mother India is the attraction of food, culture, philosophy, lifestyle, and the sense of belonging that you have in your homeland, which Indians still remain attracted to. I don't know what the comparison is with Colombia, how large your diaspora is, whether you have lots of Colombians in America who don't come back. But I've met a few very well-spoken Colombians who've studied in America and have come back and worked here. So I'm sure that you too have a lot of people coming back. And there is nothing to compare to the joy of living and working in your own country. As I'm discovering, despite my challenges in the political environment in India, having been away for almost 3 decades, or more than 3 decades I've been away, but being in India beats being anywhere else because it's my country. And I'm sure the same is true of you in Colombia. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shashi, and to you, ladies and gentlemen. And I would encourage you to follow him in Twitter, in Facebook.
Not Facebook.
In Twitter. He's a fanatic Twitter. He's gotten into trouble because of many of the tweets he has put out. But I think you're going to be hearing from him in the near future, and I would encourage you to follow him in Twitter. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And applause for Francisco, too. Thank you.